the Danker Studio on Library Square. This is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, we have the next in our ongoing series of conversations with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Today, we'll talk about the recent circuit court decision on same-sex marriage, about solar power for city businesses and for residents, and about Salt Lake's struggling golf courses.
We're not going to give up on that as a wonderful open space and recreational opportunity. It'll be shifted to another use. It may be frisbee golf, it may be trails, it may be some combination of things.
That conversation, your summary of the day's top local headlines, an update from the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, and political cornflakes with Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. A little bit later on the show, a conversation with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. First up, though, we have these headlines. Salt Lake City Police Chief Chris Burbank held a press conference on Friday to address the recent shooting death of a dog in Sugar House. The 110-pound Weimaraner was shot to death on June 18th by an SLCPD officer who was searching for a missing 3-year-old boy in the neighborhood. The boy was later found safe. At his press conference, Burbank was visibly agitated by the public outcry surrounding the incident and said that his department has received less negative attention for the shooting deaths of some human beings. To demonstrate the harsh backlash, Chief Burbank read portions of emails sent to the department.
That officer would lay dead next to my dog. I can honestly tell you that if a cop were just to shoot my dog, I would find a way to shoot that cop. No joke, I would kill the cop that killed my dog. That pig that shot the dog needs to be executed too. There's a lot worse than that.
The police chief noted that the officer involved in the incident, Officer Brett Olson, is a seasoned veteran of the force. He was even one of a handful of officers honored for their bravery in the 2007 Trolley Square shooting. Pending the results of an investigation into the matter, Burbank didn't offer many new details, but he did say that evidence suggests that the dog was, quote, extremely close, unquote, to Olson. A rally is planned for Saturday to protest the police's handling of the incident. Burbank welcomed critical voices and appealed to the public and his officers to be as respectful as possible.
Tell you what, I am one of the biggest supporters of the ability in this nation to stand up and say the government is doing wrong and we have a problem with it. That should be done peacefully and with respect. And that's all I ask. And I welcome anybody. That's why we have that lovely plaza out front. If you have an issue with the police department, certainly come and bring it to us and we will address it.
Burbank said the department's investigation includes its Internal Affairs Office and the Civilian Review Board. He said the investigation should take about a month. Utah authorities have captured a mountain lion that startled shoppers but didn't hurt anybody Friday at a shopping center in a Salt Lake City suburb. Sandy Police Sergeant Dean Carriger says the mountain lion was spotted walking across a street and into Jordan Commons in Sandy just before 8 a.m. Officers found the cat hunkered down at the entrance of a steakhouse. Some people were taking pictures and videos, while others were unaware the cat was there. When the cat came running out, an officer fired one shot but missed. The mountain lion ran away and hid in brush near a commuter train line. Wildlife officers shot the cat with a tranquilizer gun there about an hour and a half after it was first spotted. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled against President Barack Obama this week on his recess appointments. Appointments that Utah Senator Mike Lee had said were unconstitutional. So is Senator Lee taking a victory lap? I pose that question to Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics.
Yes, absolutely. Just to catch your listeners up, the president named three people to the National Labor Relations Board last year when the Senate was out, but technically still in session. They do this thing where they, you know, they're on holiday break, but they come in every 3 days and have a little session and say they're still here so that the president can't do this recess appointment thing. After he did this, Lee led like a year-long protest, kind of a lonely protest, usually only had maybe one or two senators that would vote with him. Against every single nominee that the president had in an effort to like draw attention to what Lee was saying was completely unconstitutional. And yesterday, the entire Supreme Court, all nine justices, said that Obama was wrong and essentially that Lee was right. And so Lee's pretty happy about this, and he feels a little vindicated in his protest and is hoping that this sends a message to the president that he needs to actually work with Congress and go through Congress and not act unilaterally.
All right, Lee vindicated in his protest. Hey, Thomas, speaking of the Supreme Court, it looks like Utah's fight against gay marriage may be the case that the high court ends up taking up. And you point out that this is a little bit ironic.
Yeah, I've heard that a few times this week here in Washington. Many people, especially after the show shows like Big Love and other polygamy shows, still think Utahns practice polygamy. So people have walked up to me and joking how is Utah now standing up for quote unquote traditional marriage? Seriously though, it will be interesting to see how the state proceeds, either to ask for a full review by the Tenth Circuit or go straight to the high court. But Utah really could be the deciding case on whether gay marriage is legalized nationwide. And it's kind of fascinating that Utah will be the one, actually taking this to the high court, it looks like. Just a reminder, though, Utah's, been this kind of place before. Your listeners probably remember Utah was the 36th and final state needed to ratify the amendment to end prohibition. So, mm-hmm. Maybe in some ways people think of Utah as backwater, but we're leading in some very important issues.
Well, you bring up ending prohibition. That was an ironic thing for Utah to have led on in itself. Thomas, that's another topic altogether, but I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, Roger.
Thomas Burr is Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes. You can find a link at our website, kcpw.org. We'll be right back. Mayor Ralph Becker, thank you very much for joining us today on The Rundown.
Good to be with you again.
To begin, I wanted to talk about the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruling upholding the decision that made same-sex marriage legal in Utah. When the news broke, you were at a press conference on solar power, and we'll get to that topic in just a moment, but I wanted to mention that KCPW reporter Ryan Cunningham was there too, and he captured your reaction on hearing the news. If you'll permit me, I'll play that clip just right now.
Wait in the appellate court.
Yes!
Right?
Good deal.
It's no secret that you're a proponent for same-sex marriage. You presided over the marriages of a number of couples in the wake of that initial ruling. This new decision is another win on that front. What does the ruling mean to you and to Salt Lake City?
Well, I think for all of us that have been involved with this issue and been involved in a personal way, in my case, certainly through the work on non-discrimination ordinance in the city and through other endeavors to try to make sure that everyone has equal opportunities for justice and that we don't discriminate. The gay marriage issue has become the focal point and I think probably the culmination of what has been a movement that has been occurring very fast in civil rights across the country and in Salt Lake City in particular. Our community has been very inclusive, has been very welcoming. We have looked to stand up for the rights of gay couples and folks in the LGBT community and throughout our community who face discrimination and who simply want to be treated as equals in our society. And so for us to see the rulings, which started in Utah with Judge Shelby's decision on December 20th, that have now gone across the country in a wave of decisions without exception, I think there have been something like 18 decisions by federal courts across the country that all have ruled that it is unconstitutional under the Constitution of the United States to discriminate against gay couples getting married, is a landmark time in our country, and to have Salt Lake City and Utah in the forefront of that developing law has been a great thing.
You know, there's been a bit of a kind of capital city versus the rest of the state dynamic when it comes to same-sex marriage, hasn't there? I mean, the governor is talking about defending the state constitution, which may be at odds with the federal constitution, but the city, in the meantime, we've passed non-discrimination ordinances. We've been named America's best gay city. I can't remember the exact title, by Advocate magazine. Are we kind of an island in an ocean that is on the opposite side of this issue?
Well, there's no question the politics in Salt Lake City are different than the rest of the state, and I respect the fact that we are different. And as I've said throughout the time I've been mayor, we simply ask that Salt Lake City be allowed to be Salt Lake City, and we'll follow the wishes and desires of our community, and I've done my best to do that in my time in office. And this issue is reflective of that. On the other end, I think we see on this issue, as we do on many other issues, you can look at air quality, you can look at things we've been doing with use of energy in buildings, and how we've, I think, tried to step forward, that what we are doing, while it may not be where the state is or other parts of the state are at the time we're doing it, that over time, often the approaches that we take to things are approaches that increasingly are taken across the state and as state policy. And we're seeing that, I think, with non-discrimination. When it comes to the LGBT community, we've seen a major shift in attitudes about gay couples being recognized. It's more comfortable for people to think about that across the state, it seems like, as civil unions rather than as marriage. But regardless of the terminology, while we may have taken an early stand and worked hard to protect the rights of gay couples, it is, by every indication, becoming increasingly accepted within the state. And so certainly our politics are different, and I accept that, and try not to suggest that should be necessarily the politics of everywhere, just that we be allowed to reflect what the views and values are of our citizenry.
You know, it's interesting, the changing perceptions on this issue, and actually what you just said made me think of this all of a sudden, but representing the views and opinions of your citizenry is the argument that Governor Gary Herbert makes in defending the state constitution, Amendment 3, which was a voter-passed amendment. As, I guess, attitudes evolve on this issue, the governor has some choices to make. Is that correct? When it comes to whether or not he wants to pursue challenges to the striking down of this amendment.
He does, and you know, he said, as we all know, that you know the laws of the state of Utah, as reflected by a constitutional amendment, are contrary to what we've seen happening in the federal courts, and maybe foreshadowing what will happen ultimately with the U.S. Supreme Court. Although they kind of kicked this off with the Windsor case a year or so ago, I think the stage has certainly been set. But you know, he takes a position, and you know, I have to respect that as governor, that's the position he takes. I do hope that as he pursues that, that we see a respectful dialogue from him and for those who believe marriage has been traditionally interpreted in Utah. But I also hope that he is accepting of the fact that Utah is part of the United States. We have a U.S. Constitution. This has been interpreted now as an equal protection matter, which is part of our U.S. Constitution. And that if the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately takes this up, which I'm sure they will at some point, or just accept what's happened in the circuit courts, when that becomes the law of the land, which ultimately we know it will, that we accept it and embrace it and accept all of our brothers and sisters, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity, and really include them in every way in our society and in the rights and opportunities that our society offers.
You know, we've had this conversation before, and I imagine that we will have it again, likely as the story wends its way to an eventual sort of conclusion, maybe, as you said, at the Supreme Court. Moving on to other topics, though, as I mentioned, you were at a press conference related to solar power when this news broke. The city has invested a fair amount of time and energy and funding into getting solar arrays on some of its buildings' rooftops. As background to the conversation on energy, the EPA is requiring states to come up with a plan to reduce carbon emissions drastically by the year 2030. But alternative energy sources represent a pretty small fraction, a tiny fraction of the energy that is actually consumed here. Why is this investment in solar money that is well spent by the city?
Well, first of all, from a pure dollar point of view, our investment of solar pays off. There's an initial capital investment, obviously, in solar panels and in the equipment around solar. But we have seen with the public safety building, with other facilities that we are putting solar on and moving more towards the renewable energy and achieving much greater energy efficiency than our codes currently require, that the payback is a matter of a few years or several years, depending on what approach we take. And from that point forward, there are savings to the taxpayers of our city. So from a pure financial point of view, this makes sense. We don't build a public safety building or a city facility for a few years, 10 years. We build it for decades. But beyond that, I mean, we have horrible air quality problems in this valley. And much of that is the result of the using fossil fuel power. Mm-hmm. And if we can reduce our fossil fuel power use, we're helping improve air quality. And then when we look at climate change and climate disruption that we're seeing the effects of, and we are increasingly seeing the effects in different ways all across our country and across the globe, that are enormously expensive to us long term. Whether we look at it from health, whether we look at it from cost, whether you look at it in terms of energy security in our country, I think it is incumbent on us to make the investments that are both wise investments financially and smart investments, I think, in terms of our city and our air quality in the region, but also address what are long-term issues facing us from climate change. So we are absolutely committed to converting our city facilities and providing the right incentives and conditions for businesses and for residents to invest in energy efficiency and renewable energy. Project Skyline, which we announced a few months ago, was Salt Lake City's fortunate to be one of 10 cities across the country that is has been a focal point for resources and attention to help convert our larger commercial buildings to more efficient energy use into renewable energy. So to me, this is really just what makes sense. This is something we should be doing as a community, and I think we'll be well served short-term and long-term.
You were at this press conference with your sustainability director, Vicki Bennett, and Rocky Mountain Power's Aline Bentley. These projects are city initiatives. They do have funding from a variety of sources. Rocky Mountain Power was on hand because it used funds from its ratepayers who were involved in the Blue Sky program to award a grant that put 136 solar panels on the roof of Plaza 349 in downtown Salt Lake City. The city can afford to invest in this, but a lot of homeowners and others say that the cost is prohibitive. Recently, Rocky Mountain Power asked the Utah Public Service Commission to approve a $4.25 monthly fee for customers with rooftop solar. There's a cohort of environmental groups who say that this is wrong, and they've organized a group to fight the proposed fee hike. The city's leading on green initiatives, but in the meantime, environmentalists are saying that a city partner, Rocky Mountain Power, is putting up roadblocks to solar power for residents. Is there a disconnect there?
Well, first of all, Rocky Mountain Power works under a regulatory regime that we've set up in this state that requires them really to look at short-term costs, not the full costs of the effects of their generation using fossil fuels and coal in particular. They, I think, work within some flexibility to help do things like the Blue Sky program. And I applaud them for that. But where we need to go is to reflect the full costs of our energy use. And while they are, I think, trying to figure out how they accommodate solar power and use of solar power and make that fair within the rate structures they have, I'm hopeful that the Public Service Commission will recognize that this isn't just a month-to-month dollar cost. When we look at the price of the costs in healthcare from air pollution problems, when we look at the price of what it costs us to protect our investment in fossil fuels across the country, energy security, when we look at the cost long term, not just the cost of the immediate installation of solar and the payback of that over several years, which does have a reasonable payback for people who are willing to make that investment, mm-hmm. that it makes sense for us to be investing in solar. In fact, we should be supporting solar energy use where it can be done, and it's going to vary from house to house and business to business, but we live in a climate and in a place where we have good solar gain, and we can take advantage of that as a source of power.
And so you'd like to see the Public Service Commission say we shouldn't have this fee on the price of solar for residents.
You know, my view is that we shouldn't. On the other hand, I will say this, that we need to look at our whole rate structure, mm-hmm. And we need to look at our rate structure in a way that recognizes that Rocky Mountain Power, as a regulated monopoly, gets and needs to get a rate of return on its expenditures. But we need to rebalance that equation a little bit, I think, to reflect the full costs. Mm. And I'm not sure that's done today under our current rate system for electric utilities. And I would hope that the Public Service Commission, as it moves forward, that it will consider those full costs and come up with something that's fair for Rocky Mountain Power as it is for users of solar, but does not discourage the change that we all need to be making towards renewable energy resources.
I'm realizing there's an entire conversation we could have here about distributed energy, the turn from coal-fired power plants to greater investment in natural gas, for example, And it's a conversation that could go on for quite a while. I think I'm going to drive us away from it. Our past few conversations, I've ended the discussion saying we'll have to save golf for another conversation. Today, I'd like to ask you about the city's golf courses in relation to the budget. The background here is that the golf program has millions of dollars in deferred maintenance costs, and the water bill for golf just last year was $1.3 million. Salt Lake Tribune reports that Rick Graham, director of public services, said that golf's annual revenues of about $8 million cover only day-to-day operations. Your administration commissioned a report from the Florida-based National Golf Foundation, which had a number of recommendations, including suggesting closing some courses or at least changing them. I know the city council, you know, is weighing in on this, but are we at a point where we are really considering closing golf courses in the city?
Well, the issue of golf and what we do with golf courses and how we pay for golf courses has been around for a long time, and it has been on the table ever since I've been mayor. So this is 7 years now. Mm-hmm. We pay for golf with fees, not the capital cost, the original development necessarily of those golf courses. But it has been a separate fee. We call it an enterprise fund, and that's true for a number of other portions of city government. But we have been working at a deficit for golf the whole time I've been in office and for many years before that. And the reasons are pretty simple. The number of golfers has not increased in the last 20 years. The number of golf courses in our region has doubled. And so we have fewer golfers using our city golf courses. We have to be competitive in terms of the prices we charge with everybody else in the region. And yet the number of golfers has not been going up. We have been working and trying all kinds of different ways to market people, to get them to golf more, to provide incentives for kids to get into golf, to look for different ways to manage our courses, to generate more revenue. And the fact of the matter is that the sort of basic equation financially for golf in Salt Lake City, as is true across the country for the most part, is that it doesn't pay for itself. Well, here we have these wonderful assets and great golf courses and great opportunities for people to play golf in our city. But we have been eating away at what was a reserve to a point where this year we cannot continue to operate golf courses without tapping into the general fund. And both the city council and I have taken the position, as have past mayors and councils for decades now, that golf should be self-sustaining. It's something that is a for-fee play. It's not something that everybody does. And that equation just doesn't work anymore. So we are, and I should say the study that you mentioned is one of a number of studies that we've done over the years. This most recent one was commissioned at the request of the city council. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're all feeling some comfort in that we have been trying year after year after year and been trying all kinds of different ways to figure out how to keep golf going. But as you said, there's some things you need to continue to make capital investments in golf courses, whether that's for water systems, whether that's to upgrade clubhouses or bathrooms, or whether it's to fix some things that are happening at golf courses. And those things, we keep deferring maintenance, and it just can't work any longer.
Forever, right? You know, after talk of closing or even altering Rose Park golf course, residents descended on a city council meeting, and a lot of them demanded that the course not be closed or changed. It's likely to be the same reaction the city gets at any other course it proposes changing or closing. For example, the city council's budget suggests cutting Nibley Park golf course from 9 to 6 holes. Is there any chance that other improvements recommended by the consultant's report might be adopted instead of closing courses, or does it have to include the closure or drastic changing of courses?
Well, I would love not to close courses, and I think the city council feels the same way. So it's not a question of desire, and as I said, trying so many different things over many years now to make the golf courses to continue to sustain them and allow them to operate. It costs a lot more money to operate a golf course than it does other kinds of open space, or most other kinds of open space. So I cannot imagine a scenario going forward, given all of the study and analysis and the financial position we're in, without having to change the uses at this open space golf courses, so that it is something that can sustain itself. And maybe the time will come in the future, if golf courses get closed, where the popularity of golf increases and then there's a much greater demand for golf than there is today, and we want to preserve those opportunities. But it's at this point, I think, hard for me and the city council to imagine a scenario going forward where we continue with the 6+ golf courses. There's one golf course that's more than 18 holes that we have in the city, and for that to be able to function. On the other hand, I think we are absolutely committed to preserving and protecting this incredible asset, these open spaces, and to the parks and recreational opportunities that people have in the city. And we're including in this discussion a much broader discussion of, you know, what are the needs today that we're not meeting? Mm-hmm. What are the natural open space opportunities and the trails opportunities that we're not meeting today? And how can we take advantage of these wonderful open spaces to provide for our community, given today's conditions?
I hear in this a little bit of an idea of conversion of particular courses, maybe to something different, some kind of park. I mean, this is what I'm hearing from what you're saying right now, is that conceivably this becomes, you know, one course or another becomes something that is a more open space related for public enjoyment.
Right. And we've already, actually, the city council and I have already made the decision as it relates to the par 3 golf course. Mm-hmm. That we're going to, it's a beautiful open space. We want to maintain it. It was actually given by the state to the city a number of years ago because they couldn't afford to keep it going, and they made it available to us, and we've been trying and it hasn't worked. But you know what? We're not going to give up on that as a wonderful open space and recreational opportunity. It'll be shifted to another use. It may be frisbee golf. It may be trails. It may be some combination of things. And I think we're going to be trying to understand what's the best course of action going forward that gives our community, the residents and folks who visit our community, the best recreational opportunities, including golf, mm-hmm. And take advantage of these great open spaces we have going forward. And we're going to actually try to work pretty quickly. They completed their budget, but this is kind of a hangover item. Mm-hmm. And we're going to try to move pretty quickly and see if we can come up with some proposals going forward.
Okay. And those will see public light of day? I mean, those proposals?
Yes. Okay. I think, in fact, I was just meeting with the chair of the city council this morning. This was a topic of our discussion about sort of timeline and a public process to try to make some decisions going forward. But we know we cannot continue with the status quo.
Okay. I know we're a little bit over our time. I'm going to ask you one last question, and we'll cut it off there. But before we go, fireworks season is coming up. You had wanted to see restrictions on the use of fireworks, and that was reflected in your proposed budget. City Council gave $40,000, or said that $40,000 of funding could be used for fireworks, with a caveat that it is contingent upon good air quality. What do you think of that decision?
I think it's a fair decision. I think, you know, what happened in the course of the budget deliberations and the debate within the council was that they recognized that fireworks can be an air pollution problem, and under certain conditions, we won't be having fireworks. I think it started the discussion on us for going forward about, are there alternatives for us to celebrate the 4th and the 24th, our two great national and state holidays in July? And are there some alternatives that can both save us money or provide some alternative funding for doing that and still recognize those celebratory occasions? And I appreciate the discussion, the seriousness with which the council took it. I realize we had a disagreement, but I think they came up with a good result.
Great. Mayor Ralph Becker, thanks very much for taking the time again.
Thanks. Good to be with you again.
And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show is produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help today from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Beginning next week and through the summer, we'll continue to bring you your top local news every day at 5 p.m., but The Rundown will be re-airing some of our favorite interviews from the past year while we focus on research and fundraising. If you value local news and haven't made a donation in a while, I encourage you to go to kcpw.org and make your pledge of support today. Thanks for listening.